the measures that were gained. And it is frightening to see the big push by people in leadership positions to return to the way we were. And I'm hoping and praying that our young people will step up again and say, no, we're not going back.
Janice Kelsey.
That's what those two legislators did.
Thank you so much for being with us. Longtime civil rights activist in Birmingham, Alabama, and Paul Kicks, You Have to Be Prepared to Die, his new book. Thank you.
Tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Soul Queens and Blues Kings, making a real concert on Sunday, May 7th from 4:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. Norman Boogie Cat, Sylvester, and band bring together regional rhythm and blues acts for a night of music and dance as a benefit for healthcare for all Oregon. Again, that's Soul Queens and Blues Kings making a real concert on Sunday, May 7th from 4:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a bombshell announcement from Oregon's Secretary of State. Another candidate steps up, exploring a run for Washington State's governor. And the war in Sudan, pitting rival factions of that nation's military against each other, as hundreds die and thousands are injured. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 2nd, 2023. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. Oregon Secretary of State Shamia Fagan announced today she will resign effective Monday, May 8th. She released a statement saying, quote, "While I am confident that the ethics investigation will show that I followed the state's legal and ethical guidelines in trying to make ends meet for my family, it is clear that my actions have become a distraction from the important and critical work of the Secretary of State's office," end of quote. Just yesterday, Fagan held a news conference announcing that she was giving up a side job working for a cannabis company. Here's part of what she said yesterday.
I will start by sharing that I terminated my consulting contract with Verity Holdings yesterday, and I released the contract to the media earlier this morning. I owe the people of Oregon an apology. I owe the diligent professionals in my agency an apology. I am truly sorry. I exercised poor judgment by contracting with a company that is owned by my political donors and is regulated by an agency that was under audit by my audits division. I am sorry for harming the trust that I and so many others have worked so hard to build, and I will begin working to build that trust back today. The incredible team I have worked furiously over the weekend to compile the questions that are still outstanding. I'm going to do my best to address them, and then I will take your questions. Earlier this year, outside of my official duties, I began working for supplemental income, both at Willamette University Law School, teaching a class, and as an independent contractor with Verity Holdings, consulting on the cannabis industry outside of Oregon. I diligently followed all Oregon government ethics published guidelines for private employment for public officials. These are the exact same ethics rules I've followed for a decade as a legislator since I became a legislator in 2013. I look forward to the Ethics Commission because they will confirm that I faithfully followed Oregon's ethics rules and laws. I'm even more eager for the Department of Justice to publish their findings because I know that they will verify that the hardworking auditors in the Oregon Audits Division conducted their work with independence and integrity. It's entirely my fault that it's even a question, and I'm very sorry. So I am not here today to defend my rule following. I'm here today to own that there's a difference between following all the rules and doing nothing wrong. And I broke your trust, and that was wrong. And I am truly sorry. I want to start with kind of the outstanding questions about why I use my free time to earn supplemental income and how I came to have a contract with Verity Holdings. I remember when I started my first job after college in 2003 in retail, this was 20 years ago, I was making $60,000 per year, but I was planning to go to law school and leave that job. And my dad was baffled. He was baffled why I would ever leave that job to go to law school because $60,000 was way more than he'd ever made in a year in his life. And it was a risk. But I went to law school, and when I got my first entry-level job as a brand new lawyer in Oregon in 2009, my starting salary was $105,000 a year. 14 years later, I'm starting over financially after a divorce. I have two young kids. I have student loans and other bills. I'm a renter in the expensive Portland metro area, and I'm the sole income earner in my household. So, to put it bluntly, my Secretary of State salary alone is not enough for me to make ends meet. That doesn't change the fact that for many Oregonians, they make less than that, including both of my parents before they passed. And I'm going to continue to fight for every Oregonian to have the fair shot they deserve. But this is my financial reality. And that's why I followed Oregon government ethics guidelines and began earning supplemental income in my free time. I deeply, deeply value public service. I've always known that it's a sacrifice. And I want you to know that I am deeply honored to serve as Oregon Secretary of State, regardless of the compensation. So how did I come to have a contract with Verity Holdings? Through my work and my social life, I've met many, many people in the cannabis industry, including the owners of La Moda. They became donors to my campaign in 2020. We have kids the same age. And since we met in 2020, I've seen them socially from time to time. In February, we were catching up socially. And I mentioned that I was excited to teach a class at the law school in Willamette for supplemental income. And Rosa mentioned that her company was looking to expand outside of Oregon and looking for contractors to do, you know, research on the industry in U.S. states and territories. This opportunity interested me because it was something I was highly qualified to do. Having gone through law school and been an attorney for a decade, I'm a very good researcher. I knew it was something I could do from home during my free time and was focused outside of Oregon. Before beginning the contract, I spoke with the very helpful staff at the Ethics Commission three times to make sure that I understood everything that was different about private employment now that I'm Secretary of State compared to when I was a legislator.
Oregon Secretary of State Shamia Fagan, who has announced her resignation today. Governor Tina Kotek released a statement herself saying, quote, "Secretary Fagan informed me of her decision to resign. I support this decision. It is essential that Oregonians have trust in their government," end of quote. Fagan will continue on the job till May 8th. Then Deputy Secretary Cheryl Myers will take over until the governor appoints a new Secretary of State. Meantime, in Washington State, yesterday, Washington Governor Jay Inslee announced he will not seek a fourth term as governor. Today, Attorney General Bob Ferguson said he's exploring a run for governor with this announcement.
"As a son of a public school teacher and a Boeing employee, I didn't have political connections when I first ran for office. How did I take on the establishment and defeat a 20-year incumbent? I ran a grassroots campaign and knocked on 22,000 doors, and this is the first home I visited. Let's see if the couple I met back then is still here."
"I'm so proud of you."
"Thank you very much, Mrs. Sawyer. I really appreciate that."
"I've never been afraid to take on big challenges, and I've never forgotten who I'm fighting for. We're standing up for what's right, and we've won. A lot."
This case brought by Washington State and Minnesota, this absolutely cut the Trump administration off at their knees.
"We have an American hero, and that's the Attorney General of Washington. He stood up to bigotry and racism and contested it.
When Donald Trump attacked women and students and working people time and time again, Bob Ferguson stood up for what is right, and I want to personally thank him for that.
He convinced the feds not to challenge legalized pot. He pushed for a faster cleanup at Hanford.
Because of our great work of our Attorney General Bob Ferguson, we now will be free to continue to dispense this to women in Washington State.
He's showing up for sexual and reproductive health care in Washington. Bob Ferguson is there for us.
What he's been doing for our most harmed communities from the opioid epidemic is huge.
Let's talk about the result and the end game of swinging for the fences.
Yeah, it's $500 million that's coming to Washington and all the local jurisdictions.
I came here when I was 7 years old in 2002 from Caracas, Venezuela. All throughout my college career, I was a DACA beneficiary. I want to thank Bob Ferguson for taking the chance to fight for my community and responding to this unconstitutional and immoral act against people like me.
If the overwhelming majority of Dreamers were Caucasian, does anybody really think this president would have taken the action he took yesterday?
It's outrageous.
Bob Ferguson showed up for me in a way that was really meaningful and helpful to me. In the aftermath of this horrific shooting in Mukilteo, where my son was nearly taken, and I witnessed the grief of three families who've lost their young children, here is Washington State's highest law enforcement officer. He's already got legislation drafted to change things.
I propose addressing ghost guns. That's been adopted. I proposed for 6 years banning high-capacity magazines. The legislature last year adopted that change. Now it's time to ban the sale of assault weapons. I'm proposing that as well.
The new ban on the sale of so-called assault weapons, the bill was signed into law this afternoon.
Ferguson tweeted, "My office is undefeated in court against the gun lobby. We plan to keep that record intact."
Here's what I believe. Washingtonians must have the freedom to make their own healthcare decisions, to be safe, to breathe clean air, and drink clean water.
That's Bob Ferguson, Washington's Attorney General, announcing that he's exploring a run for governor.
When a lead union organizer said she was sent home for wearing a union t-shirt, the crew at Starbucks Union Plaza at Portland State University walked off. They say they're holding an unfair labor practice strike.
I don't know what I've been told.
Starbucks is getting old.
What's the story, Lauren? What happened here?
Well, we just unionized on Friday, unanimously, and then today, May Day, I wore my union shirt, and I was told to clock off, and so that is illegal. So now we're on strike.
The PSU location is the 16th Starbucks shop to go union in the Portland area. It's hotter and more humid. But at the same time, the air is getting cleaner in parts of California. Suzanne Potter explains.
The ocean is warmer, so more moisture evaporates. Meteorologist Wang Zhang at UC San Diego says that makes the temperature feel even warmer.
Over the past 25 years in LA, the temperature increase was about 0.5 degree. But if you include the humidity effect, it is more like 2 degrees.
Zhang is talking in Celsius, so that translates to a rise of a full degree Fahrenheit just since the late 90s. In fact, the mercury in LA registers on average more than 4 degrees Fahrenheit higher than it did back in the 19th century. That's because of the urban heat island effect, where the sun's heat is trapped by black asphalt, dark buildings, and car exhaust in the city with less tree canopy to cool things down. UCLA geography professor Park Williams says not only that, our marine layer, which acts as the region's air conditioner, has been thinning out since before the 1970s.
Summertime clouds, they're burning off earlier in the day. And so across a lot of LA over the last 50 years, the actual number of hours per day when there are low clouds during the summertime has been cut in about half.
The good news is air quality has improved by leaps and bounds, driven by clean car standards. Ed Aval is professor of clinical preventive medicine at USC. He says ozone levels are at less than half of what they were in the 1950s.
I grew up in Los Angeles, so for me, it's not a 30-year story, it's a 60-year story. And, you know, I remember going to school here when it was so smoggy, some days they wouldn't let us out to play on the playgrounds. And so those days mostly are gone now. And so that really is a success story.
The extreme wildfires of the past 5 years have actually reversed some of our progress on air quality. Experts say the future will depend on fewer fires and more electric vehicles and renewable energy. I'm Suzanne Potter.
Environmental groups are closely watching a case that could impact drinking water for 1 in 3 people all across the country. Roz Brown reports it's in the hands of the U.S. Supreme Court.
The High Court heard oral arguments last year in Sackett versus the Environmental Protection Agency, with a ruling expected any day. It dates back 14 years when the EPA halted construction on an Idaho home owned by Michael and Chantel Sackett, arguing it jeopardized protected wetlands. Rachel Kahn with the Amigos Bravos Environmental Group says an arid state like New Mexico is in the crosshairs.
Many of our streams are small, and these administrative actions have really focused on stripping away protections from smaller waterways.
If the Supreme Court rules against the EPA, it's estimated the drinking water of 1 in 3 people across the country could be at risk. A study by the Tulane Institute on Water Resources Law and Policy concluded a favorable ruling for the Sacketts could have wide-ranging impacts and leave wetlands management up to states. Kahn says that's a problem in New Mexico, which is one of only 3 states without a surface water quality permitting program, which could leave its wetlands with the fewest protections.
We may not have many of them, but they do a lot of work to protect our watersheds. They filter out pollution, they help maintain stream flows, they provide wildlife habitat, so they're critically important to the functioning of our watersheds overall.
In 2019, the EPA released its Waters of the United States rule to restrict what falls under the purview of the 50-year-old Clean Water Act. It was scrapped by the Biden administration a year later.
Up to 96% of our waterways were left unprotected under Trump administration's interpretations of previous Supreme Court decisions about this issue.
Kahn says indigenous and low-income communities in New Mexico, those who already suffer the most from toxic water pollution, would be especially impacted by a ruling in favor of the Sacketts. This is Roz Brown.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy, a low down to 51. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy, a slight chance of rain up to a high of 70. Today in history, on this date in 1933, the legend of the Loch Ness Monster was born. A newspaper wrote about a couple who claimed to have seen an enormous animal rolling and plunging on the surface of the water in Scotland. Our quote of the day is from Chris Van Allsburg. The inclination to believe in the fantastic may strike some as a failure in logic or gullibility, but it's really a gift. A world that might have Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster is clearly superior to one that definitely does not. The war in Sudan is pitting rival factions of the nation's military government against each other, so far leaving at least 559 people dead and injuring another 4,000. Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Sudan's civil war is a familiar story. A dictator is overthrown after many years in power. The hoped-for transition to civilian government is thwarted by the military in a coup. Military leaders decide to share power, then start fighting among themselves. Foreign forces of various stripes see threats to their investments and choose sides. The country's civilians are caught in the middle, cowering in their homes or fleeing for their lives. We are seeing another refugee crisis in neighboring countries as well, as, according to World Health Organization, a healthcare crisis, as people are unable to access clean water or vaccinations. And as for peacemaking, no honest broker is in sight. Sudan, independent since 1956, is one of Africa's most populous and largest countries. It is also one of the world's poorest, ranking near the bottom of the UN's Human Development Index. Still, like so many other developing countries, Sudan has the resources to be an economically prosperous state. It is rich in critical minerals and has great agricultural potential. But all that appears to have accomplished is attracted outside interests that seek to exploit it by aligning with one or the other Sudanese faction. It's a recipe for a failing state. How did this happen? In brief, the dictator Omar al-Bashir, in power for 30 years, was overthrown in 2019 following an outpouring of popular anger. His murderous regime, which had resulted in an estimated 300,000 dead, was on the docket of the International Criminal Court for an extraordinary array of human rights abuses. But formation of a civilian government with popular hopes rising for a free and open society did not follow. Instead, a military coup took place in late 2021, led by al-Bashir's closest supporters. The coup leaders, the heads of the army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Force, agreed to share power, until now, when a civil war within the military has erupted. As they fight one another, a Libyan warlord, Egyptians, and the Russian mercenary group Wagner have become involved. The Wagner group is familiar because of its role in the Ukraine war. Headed by a powerful oligarch, Yevgeny Prigozhin, Wagner has a footprint in Sudan, Chad, and a few other African states where opportunities exist to exploit internal divisions and grab some of the country's riches for Mother Russia. As the Washington Post reports, over recent years, Russia's paramilitary Wagner group has established close ties with Sudan's secret security forces and sought to exploit these connections to advance Moscow's economic and military interests, including lucrative gold mining concessions and arms deals. In Chad, a recipient of U.S. military aid as part of the Biden administration's counterterrorism effort, a repressive government has killed peaceful protesters. The Wagner group is said to be recruiting soldiers for a future attempt at seizing power. Russian adventurism in places like Sudan and Chad pose a serious, but again, quite familiar problem for Washington. Whether or not to intercede in the name of U.S. national security in highly unstable political and military circumstances where human rights are being widely flouted and no legitimate local partner exists to work alongside. Peace has been elusive. Casualties are mounting, and as many as 300,000 people might eventually make their way to neighboring Egypt, Chad, and South Sudan. Several African countries, along with the U.S., are seeking to extend a ceasefire. One experienced observer writes that the odds are against the peacemakers. Quote, when conflict did not end in Sudan after the 2005 Comprehensive Peace Agreement, which marked the end of two decades of civil conflict, the international community fell into a familiar pattern of never-ending peace negotiations. Yet the problem is that conflict resolution focused on signing peace agreements that split power between armed groups, no matter how many provisions on political reforms are added, rarely leads to sustainable peace. Basically, there is no authority that holds these groups to their promises. Instead, the armed groups busy themselves with preparing for the next round of intrigue and fighting, which one account shows is how the fighting started. Meantime, other stakeholders, NGOs, women, non-military influencers, are not brought into the peace process. Democracy in Sudan is equally elusive. The two military leaders were supposed to preside over a democratic transition this year, but obviously power is more attractive to them. Neither leader is likely to yield to the other and integrate into a single Sudanese army. Every effort should be made, of course, to persuade the warring general to come together in the name of Sudan's future, but such a spirit of sacrifice is nowhere to be found. And even if they do agree to a power-sharing arrangement, history is not on the side of it working. Eventually, one side will win out, but what will not win is either peace or a democratic transition. Meantime, as one journalist is reporting from Khartoum, ordinary people have only one goal, survival amidst the chaos and destruction. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
Rallies take place across the U.S. on International Workers' Day in support of workers' and immigrants' rights. A Montana state representative sues to get back inside the state house. And U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy says he supports additional aid for Ukraine, but still wants to cut federal spending. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's the latest edition of 2023 Talks.
If you believe in justice, you have to believe in economic justice and the right of workers to form a union and to negotiate decent contracts.
Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont congratulates workers from the Ben & Jerry's flagship store in Burlington as they announce their intent to form a union. Rallies took place across the U.S. in support of the essential workers who keep the economy running. 2022 was a strong year for the labor movement, with some 200,000 more workers gaining union representation. Montana State Representative Zoe Zephyr is suing her state and its House Speaker over her censure.
There is nothing more beautiful than that, nothing more pure or fundamental to the country and the beautiful city we want to be than holding the powerful accountable when they do wrongs.
Zephyr argues the legislature took unlawful action against her last week when she spoke out against a bill to restrict gender-affirming health care for minors. She is asking the court to allow her to return to the House floor. Several constituents are also part of the lawsuit, claiming they have been denied their right to representation. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy is distancing himself from some members of the GOP who oppose additional aid to Ukraine. Speaking from Israel, where he addressed the Israeli Knesset, McCarthy told a Russian reporter his country must pull out of Ukraine.
I do not support what your country has done you to Ukraine. I do not support your killing of the children either.
McCarthy addressed domestic concerns and said he has not yet heard a response from President Biden regarding negotiations over the debt limit. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says the U.S. will be unable to pay its bills by June 1st.
Lies have consequences. The truth does not know red or blue.
Dominion Voting Systems attorney Justin Nelson announced the company's settlement in its defamation lawsuit against Fox News for promoting false election conspiracy theories. A new survey finds nearly three-quarters of U.S. adults say the news media is increasing political polarization. Overseas voters and military members from Michigan will have more time to cast their absentee ballots under a bill signed by Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Following the 2020 presidential election, 4.6% of Michigan military and overseas ballots were rejected, compared to less than 1% of all absentee ballots. And Washington Governor Jay Inslee says he will not seek a fourth term in office. The 72-year-old Democrat aimed to make his state a leader in progressive policies from climate change to gun violence prevention. Inslee is currently the longest-serving U.S. governor in office. I'm Catherine Carley.
Broadband satellite designed to serve rural Alaska blasts into orbit. A tribe leads a vigil at California's capital for missing and murdered indigenous people. And a pair of studies targets the epidemic of childhood obesity. With these stories and more, here's National Native News.
It took four tries, but a Pacific Dataport satellite finally blasted off from a SpaceX launch pad at the Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral, Florida on Sunday night.
And liftoff of Viasat 3. Go Viasat, go Falcon Heavy.
Pacific Dataport hopes to serve tribes in remote parts of Alaska, where broadband service has been unavailable or cost prohibitive. For 3 days, the flight was delayed due to the elements and technical issues. But on Sunday, a rocket called Falcon Heavy successfully carried the satellite into space. Brian Murkowski, a spokesperson for Pacific Dataport, says the Aurora 4A will be a game changer.
Remote communities will have effectively the same capabilities and services that you would get in Seattle or San Francisco or LA. And furthermore, it won't cost you an arm and a leg. It will be competitive.
The Aurora 4A is positioned higher above the Earth and looks down directly on Alaska, which provides some new options for broadband and cell service customers. Pacific Dataport says Aurora 4A is a first of its kind, a micro-geostationary satellite, smaller in size but with advanced technology that gives it more data capacity. In the days leading up to the National Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Indigenous People, Yurok tribal leaders will be participating in a series of events, including candlelight vigils, testimonies, a flower drop, and more at the California State Capitol to elevate tribally led efforts to resolve the ongoing crisis. For more information on the events, please visit yuroktribe.org. A couple public health studies are trying to prevent childhood obesity in tribal communities. Emma Vandernindy of the Mountain West News Bureau reports on their approaches.
The Johns Hopkins Center for Indigenous Health launched a study to see if providing water and educating mothers would help prevent early childhood obesity on the Navajo Nation. Every week, home health coaches talked with the moms about sugary beverages, breastfeeding, and other nutritional topics. Some families also received home deliveries of water. Leonla Nelson is one of the home health coaches. She says one of the main challenges mothers brought up was how their moms spoiled their babies.
There was a lot of conversation along of like how to have these conversations with your parent in a respectful way of like, this is my child. I want them to be healthy.
The results of the Johns Hopkins study were striking. The children of parents who received water and the teaching had a lower body mass index. Rontel Hale, a participant, says she can see improvement in her son due to the study.
It's a lot of help. It also helps not just you, but also helps your little ones.
Other groups have also looked into water-based solutions. A few years ago, the Notabagay III Foundation launched the Water First Learning Communities. It was a cohort of eight Native organizations focused on increasing water consumption. For National Native News, I'm Emma Vandenhainde.
I'm Jill Freitas.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 2nd, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertoff, Althea Billings, Suzanne Potter, Alex Gonzalez, and Roz Brown. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.
We'll be previewing two very special concerts on today's News in Depth. The first features the world premiere of Jessica Meyer's Because I Will Not Despair and the West Coast premiere of Kareem Rustam's Hurry to the Light, performed by Inmalee Erebus, Portland's acclaimed female vocal ensemble, and Camerata PYP, Portland Youth Philharmonic's Chamber Orchestra. The second concert is PYP's season closer. They'll be performing Beethoven's Ninth Symphony for the first time in the orchestra's 99-year history. Our guests in the first segment are Anna Song, Artistic Director Inmalee Erebus, composer Jessica Meyer, poet Alicia Jo Rabins, and composer Kareem Rustam. In the second segment, we welcome PYP's musical director and conductor, David Hatner. Anna, Alicia, Kareem, and Jessica, first, thanks for joining us today. And then Anna, I have the first question for you. You're the artistic director and conductor of Inmalee Erebus, similar to David Hatner's position with Portland Youth Philharmonic. And there are seven women vocalists in the ensemble. Can you give us a little background on IM, how you got together over 16 years ago, and the mission of the ensemble?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Thank you for having me. We initially started just very informally. I had recently moved to Portland, and I was talking with a friend of mine, Tuesday Roop, who has since moved away to the East Coast. And we were just kind of getting to know each other, and we both realized we had a love of early music. And so we decided to get a few other friends together in my kitchen and just sing